Welcome, my name is Divine. This is episode 480 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we'll be going over the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK Step 3 exams. And this is going to be series 101. Big milestone there. Okay, so let's just get right into it. So what if they give you a question about a 22-year-old male and he comes into the emergency room because for the past 12 hours, he has been having severe knee pain. And they tell you that on physical exam, the right knee is red, it's warm, it's erythematous. And then they ask you for your next best step in management. And obviously, in that case, you're going to think of atherosynthesis. But let me maybe present a different question to you. What if they tell you that, or this person that they show you, they maybe play a video or they show you pictures of the person's skin. This is how the USMLE will do it. And you notice that this person has so many wounds on their skin. What should you be thinking about here? Well, I would really hope you're saying that, oh, Divine, this person looks like they have a Lesch-Nyhan syndrome. So what in the world is Lesch-Nyhan syndrome? Well, many of us, you know, probably heard of it. You're basically going to see a person that has self-mutilating behavior and they have hyperuricemia. So this person, obviously, they have gout. And I'll explain the pathophase. They have gout. But this gout that they have, right, if you check their joint, because really if a person comes in with a red hot tender joint, the first thing you really want to do is to perform atherosynthesis. So if you perform atherosynthesis and get some fluid from this person, obviously, you're going to see these needle-shaped, right? These are needle-shaped, negatively birefringent crystals telling you that, oh, this person has gout, person has hyperuricemia. So what's the pathophase behind Lesch-Nyhan syndrome? Well, the pathophase is that you have a deficiency of an enzyme, a mutation in an enzyme known as HGPRT. What in the world does HGPRT stand for? Well, HGPRT stands for hypoxanthine guanine phosphoribosyltransferase, hypoxanthine guanine phosphoribosyltransferase. When you have this screwed up, basically, your purine or salvage pathway is not going to work very well. So you won't be able to salvage purines. So because you cannot salvage purines, you'll just be shunting everything towards the production of uric acid, and you're going to get in some very serious trouble as a result of that. So again, if you see a person that is very aggressive to themselves, and they have hyperuricemia, they have gout, they have its antecedents, right? And sometimes they may not tell you that they're aggressive to themselves. They may just give you a derivative of that. Like, for example, they can give you a picture and you see all these wounds on their skin, right? When you see something like this, again, think of Lesch-Nyhan syndrome. L-E-S-C-H-Nyhan. N-Y-H-A-N. I'm pretty sure this disorder, believe it or not, was discovered by a medical student back in the day. I remember, I think we were having a lecture when I was in med school back then. And there was a medical student from my school, you know, but obviously years before I attended, that discovered this together with, I think, some attending. And it's an X-linked recessive disorder, you know. It's not something that, I just put that medical student association to see if that can be a key you can use to remember the key facts of this disorder in the future. Just think of some overachieving medical student that discovered a disease, you know, in people that will be young on your exam that are aggressive to themselves and have gout. Right? So it's an X-linked recessive disease. So please, please, please do not pick this for a person that is female on your exams. This is going to be a problem exclusively males on your test. That's very, very, very important. Okay. And then what if they give you a question about a 65-year-old male? They tell you that for the past 3 months, he has lost a bunch of weight. And then he tells you that he has had a lot of redness of his urine. And he tells you that, oh, this man has smoked 3 packs of cigarettes daily for the past 40 years. And then they then tell you that a biopsy was performed and they show you a histological image. And, you know, by the way, histological images do pop up on the USMLEs. But again, in my experience, if you read the question well, you can almost predict, even if you don't know what the histology is, you can predict that, wait, this histology, they're trying to lead me down XYZ path. So They show you like a renal biopsy, and you see a lot of clear things. You know, you just see like a lot of nuclei, and you see a lot of clear white around it. And then they ask, what's your diagnosis? Well, I would really hope you're picking the answer that says renal malignancy, right? So let's talk about this in a little more detail. So what's going on with this person? Obviously, this person has renal cell carcinoma. And there are many ways they can test this thing, right? They can tell you a person has like hematuria, and then they will give you that this person has a big time polycythemia, because renal cell carcinoma can make EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion. And when it makes that erythropoietin, that can cause you to have a polycythemia. That's one. So you may wonder, Divine, what are you showing me on this histological image? Well, it could be clear cells. Many times on histology, when a person has renal cell carcinoma, you're going to see clear cells. Now, some of you may be saying, okay, Divine, how did you expect me to figure out that, wait, this person actually does have renal cell carcinoma? Well, here's the, even if I didn't know the histology, because that's the thing, many people sweat histology, but many times you can be fine if, again, you just apply a little common sense to the question that you're reading. It's just many people just get all emotional with these questions. They're not strategic. They're not methodical. And then they get in a lot of hot water. But let me explain something here. If you look at this, you're getting a question about a person that is old. That's number one. Number two, you're getting a question about a person that has lost some weight. Okay, so that tells you it's probably cancer. Number three, you're told that the person has hematuria. Okay, well, that's going to narrow things. It's going to level the playing field out pretty well, right? It's going to pretty much limit your answer to renal cell carcinoma or bladder cancer. And then number four, you're told that, man, this person has smoked 3 packs of cigarettes daily for 40 years. That's a 120-pack-year smoking history. Well, guess what? Smoking is the biggest risk factor for renal cell carcinoma and also bladder cancer, right? So just putting all those things together, at least for me, taking an exam, I'm like, oh, wait, this is either going to be renal cell carcinoma or bladder cancer. And then if you're playing odds, if you're thinking in terms of, you know, you're just like, wait, which one have I usually seen being tested on many USMLE exams or many practice tests I've taken? It's probably going to be renal cell carcinoma. So guess what? Renal cell carcinoma is going to be the right answer, right? And, you know, so that's the thing. So notice how I just used multiple clues to get to the answer, even if you don't know the histology. Again, this is something I teach people, and it's this whole concept of predictive question answering, right? Where even if you don't know the image they're presenting to you, or the video they are showing you, or the audio they are throwing in your way, if you just read a question well and think inductively, right? Think with wisdom, think with some reasoning, right? Just a little common sense and stop being emotional. You can usually arrive at the answer without a lot of stress. I know you may be like, oh, Divine, you're making it sound too easy. But to be honest with you, it kind of is. It's just many people, they get emotional and they are not systematic like at all with any of these are USMLE exams. So this person has renal cell carcinoma, right? This person has renal cell carcinoma. And again, I said that, man, they got a biopsy. So just be careful. What kind of biopsy do you get if you suspect renal cell carcinoma? I really hope you're not saying that, ooh, let's just biopsy the mass. No, you don't just biopsy the mass. No, what are you going to do? The thing you're going to do is you're going to literally remove the entire kidney that is suspicious. And then that entire kidney is the biopsy specimen. Remember, renal cell carcinoma is one of those cancers that you do not biopsy. The biopsy specimen is the whole organ, right? So if you ever want to biopsy renal cell carcinoma, you need to get a nephrectomy. You need to get a nephrectomy to get your sample, okay? Don't go and say, oh, wait, let me take just a piece of the tumor. No, that is never the right call with renal cell carcinoma. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this is a three-year-old female. They tell you that she has a skin hypopigmentation, like generalized skin hypopigmentation, and that, you know, she's 3 years old and she's developmentally delayed, that she can, she has a very poor limited vocabulary. And then they tell you that she has an unusual smell. Right. And of course, what answer will the USMLE support? They will say and they will say, oh, which of the following must be let me just put it this way. They'll put a bunch of answers and they'll put an answer that relates to hearing loss. Of course. Right. Again, the USMLEs, they're pretty classic in many of the things they do. They'll put an answer that says something related to hearing loss and getting audiometry. Right. And then obviously they'll put an answer choice that relates to PKU, you know, phenylketonuria. right? So maybe let me go over something here, because again, this is a rapid review, but I really want to try to tie some things together for you here. So why may they put an answer that relates to hearing loss with this question? Well, they're going to put it because whenever you see kids that are delayed from a language perspective, one of the first things you think about is hearing loss. That's a very common concept that they love to test on the USMLE exams. Because if you think about it, if you cannot hear, then you cannot phonate. If you cannot hear, you cannot speak. That's just the truth, right? So many times when you see a child that is completely normal in every other department, but their language is delayed, your next step on the USMLE exams is to get audiometry. Just get some kind of hearing screen, right? Because many times when kids have poor language development, they actually do have hearing loss, right? But this person just has a little more than that. That's why it's important, right? You want to, again, think globally on your exams, right? So we see this person has poor language development. They have developmentally delayed. They have generalized skin hypopigmentation, right? And then they have an unusual order. And again, to be honest with you, the USMLEs, they may not even give you this unusual order, right? This is just me being kind of nice. It's a Thursday, kind of the end of the month. Let's be kind to people today, right? But the USMLEs, they will not always volunteer that information, right? And you may be like, oh, Divine, so how are you getting at PKU? Well, I'm getting at PKU because this person has this unusual order. They have skin hypo. Honestly, even just the developmental delay and skin hypopigmentation, generalized skin hypopigmentation, should have taken you straight up towards PKU. You don't need the order. You don't need the order. Because that's one thing that puts people in a lot of trouble on the USMLEs. They're kind of expecting these picture-perfect questions. They're like, oh, Divine, I want these questions that are like gift wrap for me. I wish you all the best. No, the USMLEs, they're not going to give you gift wrap questions. What they're going to do is they're going to give you questions. You need to put the clues you get together. It may be an incomplete set of clues, but many times it will still lead you overwhelmingly to the right answer. Right. So how did I arrive at PKU? Again, developmental delay, the skin hypopigmentation is me describing albinism. Wait, what? Yeah, it's me describing albinism. Because I know some people may be like, but Divine, you know, skin hypopigmentation may mean the ash leaf spots of tuberous sclerosis. Okay, well, the thing is the ash leaf spots. Look at the term, ash leaf spots, ash leaf spots, ash leaf spots. So that means it's not the whole skin, right? It's not the whole skin, right? So seeing that it's generalized, the USMLEs are pretty much describing albinism, right? So this albinism, developmental delay, all those things, you put it together, that's PKU, right? And remember, PKU is a deficiency of phenylalanine hydroxylase. Phenylalanine hydroxylase. So when you have a deficiency of phenylalanine hydroxylase, that's how you get PKU. It's an autosomal recessive disorder. Although remember, you can also get PKU in a different form. Well, how can you? Well, the way you can get PKU in a different form is if, for example, you have, because phenylalanine hydroxylase uses a cofactor. That cofactor is known as BH4, BH4, tetrahydrobiopterin, tetrahydrobiopterin. Well, tetrahydrobiopterin, if it's not there, then guess what? PAH, phenylalanine hydroxylase, will not work. So you can get PKU if you don't have the cofactor. And that cofactor is made by a special enzyme known as THB reductase, tetrahydrobiopterin reductase, tetrahydrobiopterin reductase, THB reductase. So it's made by that enzyme. So if that enzyme also does not work, you can get PKU, right? And again, there are many ways they can go with PKU, right? They can say, oh, you know, why does this person have this skin hypopigmentation? They can ask you a question from that. And again, it's because they cannot make melanin, right? It's literally because they cannot make melanin. Because if you think about it, that PKU pathway, you know, you go from phenylalanine to tyrosine. And that tyrosine, through a series of steps, is made into melanin. So if you cannot make melanin, you're going to have skin hypopigmentation. You're going to have skin hypopigmentation. That's one. And then they may ask you what should be supplemented in this person's diet. Well, I hope you're going to say, obviously, they're going to put an answer that says supplemental phenylalanine. And many people, you know, in the heat of an exam, in the emotion of an exam, they'll pick that answer. And then they'll notice that, gee, how did I get this stuff wrong? No, you're not supposed to supplement phenylalanine because guess what? These people, they literally lack the enzyme. So since they lack the enzyme, if you give them phenylalanine, it's almost like you're worsening their problem. They'll not be able to metabolize that phenylalanine. They'll build up, cause even more symptoms. But what do you supplement in these people's diets? You need to supplement the stuff that comes right after phenylalanine. Well, what is that stuff? That stuff is going to be tyrosine. Tyrosine becomes essential because normally tyrosine is not an essential amino acid because your body can make it on its own. Your body literally converts phenylalanine to tyrosine with phenylalanine hydroxylase. But if you don't have phenylalanine hydroxylase, you cannot make tyrosine anymore. So tyrosine becomes an essential amino acid. So these people that have PKU, tyrosine absolutely positively needs to be supplemented in their diet. Okay, tyrosine needs to be supplemented in their diet. Please don't pick the answer that says to supplement phenylalanine. Sounds like an intuitive thing, but it'll be flat out wrong on your exams. Okay, it'll be flat out wrong on your exams. And I guess since we're kind of talking about albinism, let's maybe ask ourselves, what are the classic situations on the USMLEs where they test albinism? Well, one way they're going to test this is, again, if a person has PKU. That's one scenario. And that scenario can be a person that has albinism and they have a lot of recurrent infections. Well, that's going to be Chidiak Higashi, right? Chidiak Higashi, Chidiak Higashi, Chidiak Higashi, right? Again, so kind of lock in that albinism concept in your mind as something that they can test in many, 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 many different ways, right? Well, a person can just have good old albinism. Right, good old albinism, where you know they have like a tyrosinase deficiency, so they're not able to make melanin, and then they get in a lot of trouble. Okay, so again, if you love the integrations I'm giving here, I think you really love the courses that I teach. I actually have a class starting like literally the first day of September, literally tomorrow. It's an MBME test taking strategies classes for step one to step three. And then about 2 weeks from now, I have a step one class. It's a 25-hour class. It's for people taking step one or people that are taking step two, step three that have very poor foundations from step one. Let's say you really struggle during your dedicated period for step one, or you barely pass step one, or you've taken step one multiple times. You really benefit a lot from that class. And then the week after that, I have a 20-hour step two, step three course. And then actually, I believe it's on the 15th and the 16th, if I'm not mistaken, I have a biostatistics class and a social sciences and ethics class. Those are for step one to step three. Again, lots and lots and lots of people have taken these classes and they have found them to be tremendously helpful. I get emails every week. I've gotten tons of emails this week of people that have gotten like 270s, 260s, very, very high scores. And these are all people that took my course. Okay, so let's jump right back into it. Now, what if they give you a question about a person and they tell you that this person is a landscaper, and this person is a landscaper in Wisconsin, and this person has been having fevers, right? Fevers, right? But they tell you that, oh, this person doesn't have, this person has been having fevers, right? And you also notice that, you know, the person has been having chills, having a lot of myalgias, having a lot of headache, right? And they tell you that this person just has a mild rash on their trunk, but that they don't remember being bit by any kind of tick, right? And then they tell you that, oh, they show you a histology image. And in this histology image, they tell you that, a smear, right? A peripheral blood smear shows the following result, right? And in that peripheral blood smear, so this is one of those rare situations on the exams where knowing exactly what you're dealing with kind of matters. Knowing exactly what you're dealing with kind of matters, right? They'll show you a blood smear, and then they'll show you like a nucleus that looks like a kidney bean shape. And then you see like one circular thing next to it. When you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're saying, Divine, I think this person has ehrlichiosis. You're like, whoa. Divine, slow your roll there. What do you mean by ehrlichiosis? Okay, so let's explain, right? The thing is, this is a time-honored thing our friends at the MBMEs do to people all the time, right? And they know that people will massively struggle with this. So it's just something you want to kind of keep at the back of your mind. And that's this whole anaplasmosis, ehrlichiosis, babesiosis business, right? So how did I use the clues here to know that it's ehrlichiosis? Well, first things first, this person works in Wisconsin, right? That Wisconsin association, just that Midwest association is pretty strong for ehrlichiosis, right? Notice I didn't say anything about the New England area. The New England area is going to be more where you're going to see babesiosis, anaplasmosis, and Lyme disease. That's where you're usually going to find those things, right? Because remember, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, and Lyme disease, right? Borrelia burgdorferi. Those things are all carried by the Ixodes tick, right? The Ixodes tick and Lyme disease, that's kind of a New England thing there, right? But Ehrlichiosis is not going to be that New England area. Although it could be, if they really wanted to mess up your head on exams, they could be. But typically on your exams, they're going to put some kind of Midwestern association, you know, something like Milwaukee, right? So if you're a Milwaukee Bucks fan, you know, Wisconsin, just kind of make that mental association. That's one. But the thing is, honestly, the USMLE sometimes, they'll put one crazy clue, and then you'll put a bunch of like one crazy clue that doesn't fit the pattern, right? So say for example, like writing an Ehrlichiosis question or making about New England, but pretty much every other thing in the question is like specifically going for Ehrlichiosis, right? So how do you differentiate these things? The first thing is, if they want you thinking of Ehrlichiosis, the person may have a rash, although rashes are not always common with Ehrlichiosis. But people that have Ehrlichiosis, they may have a rash. They may have a rash. In anaplasmosis on your exams, they should not have a rash. That's something you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. In Ehrlichiosis, they should have a rash. They could, let me put it this way, they could have a rash, not always. But in anaplasmosis, they should never have a rash. Now, this is one of those situations where the biopsy, like the blood smear, is actually quite helpful, right? When people have Ehrlichiosis, and anaplasmosis, you're going to see morula. Right, the basically these things look like mulberries. You're going to see like these mulberry-like inclusions in the cytoplasm. Okay, these are not inclusions in the nucleus. If you're thinking of intranuclear inclusions, then you're thinking about CMV, alzheimer nucleus, CMV. No, right, in this case, we're thinking about intracytoplasmic inclusions. Intracytoplasmic inclusions, they are morally, they look like mulberries, right? So the thing is, the blood smear many times is the dead giveaway on the USMLE is now, oh, wait, I'm dealing with anaplasma versus Ehrlichia. In anaplasma, the morulae, they grow inside neutrophils. So the thing is, but again, use the little information you have to arrive at the greatest number of results that you can, right? Like for example, neutrophils. Well, many people have heard of hypersegmented neutrophils with B12 or folate deficiency. So that means the nucleus of a neutrophil, the nucleus of a neutrophil is going to have many segments. It's going to have like multiple segments, you know, like three or four segments. You're going to see almost like three or four nuclei. They're kind of stringed together. That tells you that, oh, this is a neutrophil. So if you see morulae growing inside neutrophils, that's anaplasma. But in Ehrlichia, those morulae grow inside monocytes. Remember, monocytes are the ancestors of macrophages. Macrophages, by definition, right, usually on histology on the USMLEs, you're going to see like a kidney bean-shaped nucleus, okay? Literally, the nuclei look like kidney bean shapes. If you see that, that's absolutely positively Ehrlichiosis. So you may say, oh, divine, okay, how about babesiosis? I'll talk about that in a bit, right? But also, don't forget, another key differentiating point is what transmits these things, right? What transmits these things? Anaplasma is carried by the Ixodes tick. I already said that already. But Ehrlichia is carried by the Lone Star tick. Ehrlichia is carried by the Lone Star tick, right? So how in the world do you treat Ehrlichiosis, which is the big thing that we're kind of going over here? Ehrlichiosis is going to be treated with doxycycline, although anaplasmosis is also treated with doxycycline, okay? So Ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, those are both going to be treated with doxycycline on your exams. And again, let me just say something here. Our friends at the MVMEs, sometimes instead of using the term monocyte, or using the term macrophage, they may also use the term mononuclear cell. If you see the term mononuclear cell, I want you to think about a macrophage, okay? Again, the thing is, you may wonder, Divine, why do you always, in your podcast, love to give like many different names for the same thing? I'm not doing that because I like to hear myself talk. I'm doing that because that's something the USMLEs does. They do all the time. This is something that I do very heavily with my review courses. And I teach in my test taking strategies class. The USMLEs, they love derivatives, right? They love derivatives. They know that we live in an Anki generation. So what do? These days? They take what you know and they just describe it in multiple ways, right? Or they take what you know and put something that is a little off-putting, right? Like for example, who is going to be taking step 2, step 3 and expecting some histology image, right? But the thing is, even if you don't know the full histology image, you can put 2 and 2 together. That basically the USML is, they want you to be able to like arrange almost like pieces on a chessboard and get to a final solution. Okay, so again, you cannot just be thinking in one dimension for your USMLE exams. I promise you, like you're in for a pretty stranger exam. That just FYI, right? So that's the thing. So that's why they love these derivative thinking, right? Because think about it. Why not make everyone's life easy and just call it a monocyte, right? But no, they can call it a monocyte. They can call it a macrophage. They can call it a mononuclear cell. Same thing with anaplasma, right? Why, you know, they can say, oh, neutrophil. Well, that'll make everyone's life easy. Or they can call it a polymorphonuclear leukocyte, right? So another name for a neutrophil is a polymorphonuclear leukocyte. Well, why is that? Well, because if you look at a neutrophil, they have this segmented nucleus, right? So look at the name, polymorpho. So polymorpho, poly means multiple, morpho means morphology, nuclear, leukocyte. So that means, oh, wait, this leukocyte, the nucleus has a multiple morphologies, right? That's just something that tells you that, oh, wait, I'm dealing with a neutrophil. Okay, so let's talk about babesiosis, because I said I'm going to talk about babesiosis. But what's the deal with babesiosis? Number one, that one is actually pretty easy to differentiate. It's carried by the Ixodes tick, right? But it doesn't infect any white blood cell. It goes after red cells. So people that have babesiosis, many times on your exams, they're going to have anemia. Many times on your exams, they will absolutely positively have anemia, right? They'll usually have anemia. So they may give you like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? So you see a person that goes to the New England area where they've been bitten by a tick, and you see indirect hyperbilirubinemia. You really shouldn't be thinking about like anaplasma or Lyme disease. No, you really want to be thinking about babesiosis, because babesiosis goes specifically after those red blood cells. And remember, on histology, you're going to see that Maltese cross pattern, right? Okay, I think I should probably go ahead and stop here. I feel like we've kind of hit on a lot of stuff today. But again, I do hope you find this podcast to be helpful. Again, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams and medical school exams and shelf exams. I help with ERAS applications, personal statements, rec letters, mock interviews, and things of that sort. I offer review courses for step one, a 25-hour course, step two, step three, a 20-hour course. And then I have classes for step one all the way to step three, the 2.5-hour MBME testing and strategies class, the 4-hour biostatistics review, and the 5-hour social sciences, ethics, and quality improvement class. Again, many people have taken these classes and they've done extremely well on their exams. And the classes are not lectures. They're almost exclusively all scenarios, because that's something that's more realistic to what your exam will look like. And then I have these podcasts on the major apps, Apple, Google, Spotify. I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where you can find the videos that I've made. And then finally, I have a new website called Divine Intervention, lifelessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. So just check that out. Many of you don't are Christian. So from a biblical perspective, every week I upload 2 podcasts that address a life lesson. We have more than, I think, 210 podcasts on there right now. And there's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. Again, I promise you, this stuff I went over in this podcast, you may be like, man, Divine, you were pretty basic science-y today. But I promise you, our friends at the USMLE for step 2, step 3, they're becoming a little more basic science-y, especially over the last few weeks to months. So just FYI, something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Well, I will see you in the next podcast. That'll be episode 481, God willing. Have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now.